I'm going to invite you today to come along with me on a journey that I've been on for about 6 months, and that's taken me to some rather surprising places. The journey is far from over, but it's already taken me to places that I really did not expect to find myself. And it's also taken me well beyond what's in the proceedings. So there are going to be some observations and thoughts and conclusions here that are really only here. I chose this cover of a wave because there really is a wave coming and crashing down on us. And if we ignore it, we are very likely to get swept away. If we are aware of it, we might not be able to prevent it, but at least we might be able to survive it. So it's not a pleasant picture, I assure you. But here's the basic picture to begin with. This is a depiction of the Australian ballot, better known in the US and most of the world as the secret ballot. It dates back to around the 1850s. There it is, okay. To around the 1850s. And this really, although we take it for granted today, it seems completely obvious to us, it was really a marvelous innovation. This is not just about being able to vote privately. This does more. Voting privately, you seal your vote in an envelope at home and you bring it in and you drop it off. This process of public observation of your voting in a private place without being coerced really does effectively prevent coercion. If it's a well-managed poll site, this is a pretty effective tool. And it has been effective and has worked well where it has been used for well over a century. Now, this is not used everywhere, right? There are many systems that do not achieve this level of coercion prevention. Vote by mail, I live in a vote by mail state, I don't like it, but you know, that exists in many places. There are many inferior systems out there, we know that. And there are scattered reports of various forms of coercion, employer coercion, for instance. There is certainly indication that spousal coercion, for instance, is a real issue, and something I'm particularly concerned about, and presumably exists in my state, that abused partners are disenfranchised, abusive partners get double the vote. That doesn't seem right. So this is something we'd really like to be able to deal with. And I think that the people in this room, if we were given carte blanche and told, let's design a really good election system that has all the best properties, we have good budget, we can require whatever we want, we would certainly be starting with the Australian ballot and an in-person voting system. I think that's pretty clear. Now, this is a pair of camcorder glasses. If you look very carefully, oh no, the cursor doesn't show up. Well, right around here, there's a little tiny pinhole. That's a camera. These things, here's their specs, their model. 2 gigabytes of internal memory, about 5 hours of continuous video recording, and $20. It's a problem. Just in case you think that was a unique situation, here's another pair. Maybe that pinhole is a little more conspicuous, but not much. These are the SpyNet stealth recording video glasses, just in case there is any question about their purpose. They're being marketed for stealth recording. There is a market for that. These aren't quite as impressive. They say they secretly record up to 20 minutes of video, and these are about $30, perhaps because of the snazzy packaging that they include. I don't know. But still, there are lots of these things out there, and this is today. This is what's available now. Imagine 2, 3, 5, 10 years from now. Things like this will be ubiquitous, available in all forms, everywhere, and not just glasses. Lapel pins, headbands, earrings, perhaps even physically implanted video recording. People will be recording much of their lives, and it will be commonplace. So the question now becomes, can this peacefully coexist with that? Or do we have a problem, and is this going to supplant our comfortable Australian ballot? Sorry, that slipped in there. For those of you who weren't here yesterday, my apologies. But a macro fired. Okay. We now know. Sorry, David. We already are in a position where simple coercion is possible and very, very easy. Spousal coercion, the kinds of things I just talked about. I want to coerce my partner. We go to the pool together. I give my partner a pair of camcorder glasses. I say, sign in and vote. Go ahead. We leave together. You return the glasses to me. I review your vote. We're done. You are coerced. It's really, I don't see much that can be done about that. It's not a good situation. Okay. Dan, you did it too, so. Fine. Back to the journey. Back to the real story. Let's start looking a little bit more deeply at varieties of coercion. Okay. This kind of small, narrow spousal coercion really clearly seems to be possible, and the Australian ballot is just not going to provide much of a defense against that. What about other forms of coercion? Maybe if we explore a little bit further, we'll be able to find that, okay, we can prevent some things and maybe have a better understanding of what we can and can't do, and maybe things are not that bad. So let me look first at vote selling. Maybe that's a little bit different. I don't know. Let's see. Is there any real difference? Vote selling is considered voluntary. Coercion is considered involuntary. Well, if you look at it carefully, there really isn't a whole lot of difference. Basically, a voter can voluntarily act as though the voter is being coerced. And the voter can even sell the rights to being coerced. You're not coercing me, but anybody who's willing to give me $20, I'll let you coerce me. Now, this reduction is kind of one way. Maybe vote selling is even easier than being coerced. But I'm not sure I want to know if that's the case. Already being coerced, we're saying, is pretty easy. So things look bad in either of those two cases. Well, what about local versus remote coercion? Maybe if I take you to a poll place and stand there with you, that's easy, but I can't do it if you're far away. Well, let's take a look at this issue. Can this attack be performed somehow remotely? Turns out the answer is yes. It's not hard. Here are my instructions to you as a coerced voter, if I'm the coercer. I tell you, first, find a mirror near the polls somewhere. Go into a bathroom or whatever, put on the glasses, get a good look at yourself. Record yourself looking at yourself in the mirror. Keep continuously recording from that point on. Sign in, vote. Maybe even it's a good poll site where you're voting behind a curtain. That's really going to help. You still got those glasses on. For good measure, establish a date. Go look at a newspaper someplace. Make sure we've got the right date. And then send me the recording, all in that day. The date probably isn't that crucial, but if I do that, then I know this isn't some elaborate hoax that you've been preparing for weeks, because I received this on the same day as the newspaper. You didn't have a lot of time to try to fake something. Okay? You send it to me, I've got it. Remotely, you've been coerced. Okay? Well, what about the dimension of retail versus wholesale coercion? Maybe it's hard for me to do this at a large scale, at least. Maybe there's something. Maybe there's some cost involved. So can they do this practically at a large scale? Just one individual, say? And the answer, again, is yes. So here's a way that we can do that remote coercion at scale. As a coercer, I can avoid spending the $20 per voter per election, because this amortizes, right? Spend the $20 once. And this is $20 today, right? It's going to be cheap in years to come. And maybe I, as the courser, don't even have to do that. I tell you, go buy your own or use your own recorders that you already have. So, you know, there's not going to be a lot of cost to me if I have coercive power over you. It's all very affordable. I also don't have to review all of these videos, right? I can spot check. If I have 100 employees and I tell them all how I want them to vote, and if they don't vote the way I say, you're going to get fired, then you know, voters might really be concerned about that. Maybe I only review 5 or 6 of those 100 videos that come back to me. But you know, how many employees are going to risk a 5% chance of being fired just in order to cast their one meaningless little ballot the way they want? And even if it's not 100% effective, even if a few of my employees are adamant and they vote the way they want and they're not detected, 90% compliance is still pretty good for a coercer. I'd be pretty happy. Well, happy in a matter. And also, I don't have to take a lot of time. Voters might spend hours standing in lines to vote. It might take them a long time. I don't have to watch that. I don't have to watch this at high speed. It's a lot easier for me to just go through and check how the people who I'm checking are voting. It's very easy on my end. Okay. So if you're along with me at this point in the journey, you may be rather depressed about things. I certainly have been. Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why it's not possible for a 4C just to put the glasses on someone else after looking in the mirror. Of course, they have the accidental experience of looking in another mirror.
It might be possible to sort of carefully do this and that. Yes, it's true. There may be some mitigations like this. It's a clever idea, but it's hard. You're right. This is one of perhaps some ways around this, but it's getting worse. And as these things will have all sorts of other detectors, it gets much harder. That would help as well, yes. And you could do that on the strap on the back.
Yeah. The other person might not vote the way you want, and then you're in trouble.
For instance, yes. You're still getting a vote in some sense. You're getting a coerced vote, and who cares if it's somebody else?
Yes.
Yes. See, there are good tricks. Yes, Susan, back. Well, we try to do that. We try to outlaw use of cell phones in many places. It's not terribly effective. But I
can put a cell phone in my pocket if I have to wear the glasses.
I will talk about that, I do promise. If we're using straight glasses that look like they do today, they are fairly detectable. I think the point I'm trying to make is that they're going to become less detectable in the very near future. It's going to be harder and harder to try to have counter defenses. And there are some, and I will talk about some counter defenses that are possible. But it's an increasingly bleak situation in terms of ways that people, if they want to, could hide the fact that they're recording what's going on. Okay. So this is actually kind of the nadir of my talk. From here on, I'll try to find some glimmers of hope and directions and ways we might want to change the way we'll get things. So what I'm going to do is look at another dimension of coercion, the time of coercion. And the question is, does it matter when somebody is coerced? And it turns out that does, at least to the extent that the coercion has to take place before the fact, before the vote, in any reasonable voting system. You can imagine voting systems where you have access to your vote. You can review your vote after the fact. I think we would all agree that that is a bad design. But it's possible to do that. A good election protocol should at least prevent after-the-fact coercion. Once I voted, if I wasn't coerced, if I wasn't contemplating being coerced or selling my vote, I wasn't recording myself at the time, then I can't go back and retroactively prove to you how I voted. So there's something there. There's basically a boundary after which coercion apparently can't take place. And the interesting thing here is that there are protocols which allow you to move this boundary so that coercion would have to be initiated earlier, perhaps even before registration. So one thing I want to spend a little bit of time mentioning and reviewing is the Jules Catalano-Jacobson protocol. And by the way, I want to thank an anonymous reviewer for pushing me more in this direction. I mentioned this in my original paper, but I didn't go into a lot of depth, and it's a fruitful path to follow further. So the basic idea of this protocol is it's a remote voting protocol, first of all. And when you register, you get legitimate credentials from the registrar. You do an in-person confidential, well, actually, the way it's described in the paper is not necessarily in person, but there's a confidential registration phase. You are assumed to be coercion-free during your registration. And you get a set of legitimate voting credentials. And we don't have to go into a lot of detail here about what these legitimate credentials would look like. There are a lot of possibilities for that. As it's described, there is now an optional additional step where voters who are suspicious, untrusting, might engage in some sort of interactive proofs, can be a little cumbersome, to develop some confidence that these are legitimate credentials that they've received. Voters can also generate, at their heart's content, additional illegitimate credentials, which are, to any outsider, indistinguishable from the legitimate ones. And any credentials at all, legitimate or illegitimate, can be used to encrypt a vote and cast a vote and publish the vote. But there's a public verifiable process which you can apply to all of these cast votes, legitimate and illegitimate, such that you'll get the tally of only the legitimate votes. Right? So many of you have seen this paradigm before. I think it's really an interesting paradigm. It's useful. But this basic idea of being able to generate additional illegitimate credentials that are indistinguishable allows you to give a coercer, oh yeah, here are my credentials, no problem. And the coercer is none the wiser for it if they're illegitimate or legitimate. A coerced voter may be able to keep legitimate credentials concealed. Okay, so I want to start off by just looking at a very simplified version of the JCJ paradigm, because the first problem I want to address here is the one of what if we're living in a world where we really do trust the government implicitly. We think the government's doing a great job in elections. The only problem we're trying to address is coercion. There are lots of coercive spouses or employers or whoever out there. Government is doing fine, trying to help. Can we do this? So I'm going to give a simplified version of JCJ that works in this context. And here, a credential could just be a random ID number. It could be on a slip of paper of some sort. That's all it has to be. The election officials merely have to maintain a secret list of which are the validly issued IDs. Every vote is submitted with an ID, and the election officials do a count of only the legitimate ones, and they announce. There's no transparency here. This is not a protocol that I would recommend using. There's complete trust in the election officials to do everything right. But if you do believe them, this can be pretty effective against the coercion problem that I started with. Okay? So let's build this up a little bit from here and talk about what the voter registration process might look like. And I'm going to add a very high-tech tool here that's going to help with the explanation of the process and the use. And here it is, the basket. Now, it's not just a basket. It's a basket with something in it, some credentials. Those credentials here could be smart cards. They could be simpler passive magstripe cards or prox cards. They could just be slips of paper with ID numbers written on them. There's a whole variety of credentials that may be possible and may be consistent with this model. Okay? So let's take a look at how the coerced voter can register in this scenario. Go in person to some sort of a central office. You receive a legitimate credential. On the way out, you go by the basket of illegitimate credentials and grab a handful. And the voter can mark them up in any way that the voter wishes to identify. Now, a few things I want to mention here. It's important that it be a handful, that there not be a strict upper bound. It can't be that you're allowed one illegitimate credential and that's it, because then a coercer can say, and be sure you pick up your illegitimate credential also and bring me both. So you also can't say, well, you have a limit of two, because then the coercer can say, grab two, and so on. There's an induction process here, right? Things get bad. So it has to be sort of indeterminate. You can grab a handful, and maybe if you can grab a little bit more, but there can't be a clear upper bound in how many of these illegitimate credentials you can take. And you.
Is there
a pretty easy denial of service attack against the registrar? Well, you might make it a resource issue. You might make it, you have to spend a little bit longer to get another one. And maybe the limit is a handful, what you can carry, and something that's just not, you can't take the whole basket, but one hand. And if these things are smart cards, it becomes expensive. If these are just slips of paper, it's not a big deal. So something along this line is certainly possible. And also, if you have a voter who is fearful of getting searched upon exiting, and I want to see every single credential you have, the voter could say to this presumably honest registrar, okay, I can't even leave with this legitimate credential. Please deposit this in this Dropbox. I'll give you a password for a Dropbox. Put it in Dropbox. I'll be able to get it later, but I don't even want to carry that slip of paper out with me. That's also a possibility. Okay, let's talk about the skeptical voter now. Let's get back to the scenario where I'm more at home, where I might not trust that the election is being run perfectly, that the election office is doing everything right. I want to know that these credentials are good. Well, again, I'm going to register in person, and I'm going to use one of these baskets again, but I'll use the basket on the front end. There's a basket of legitimate credentials in the front. I pick up a handful of legitimate credentials. I go up to the registrar. I pick one out and say, okay, this is going to be the one record as my legitimate credential, and the rest you should record as challenge credentials, effectively. And what will happen is any of these unselected credentials that I present to the registrar will be proven to be legitimate, some subsequent public process. They'll be open. They'll be published on the website. I can walk out with them. I can check, yep, okay, there is a correct public proof that these other credentials were legitimate, so the one that I got probably is a legitimate credential also. And of course, we can have a skeptical coerced voter, right? You go in person, you pick up some legitimate credentials from this basket. It's beginning to feel a little bit like Alice in Wonderland. One basket has legitimate ones, one has illegitimate ones. Which do you want? You pick a handful of legitimate credentials, you go through that process, pick up a handful of illegitimate credentials, you've got everything you need, mark things any way you want, dispose of what you want to dispose of anyway, maybe have them recorded in some way in a Dropbox from far away, however you want to do it. And of course, we shouldn't forget about the typical voter. What does registration look like for most people? You walk in, you get a credential, you leave. That's probably the typical scenario. And we don't want to make this any harder, and we don't have to make this any harder. These baskets of credentials, these other capabilities have to be there, but they don't have to be exercised by people who are not concerned about this process. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about some of these mitigation issues and sort of what we can do, because all we've done at this point is shifted the problem of detecting recording capabilities during voting to detecting recording capabilities while registering. Now, there are some benefits to that, and I'll talk about them, but we would like to be able to do something even if you're coerced before you register. So let's just talk a little bit about some of the measures. One thing is the election registrars can be trained more effectively, presumably, than the transient poll workers to recognize and enforce the rules. So they can be better equipped to say, no, you're not allowed to do this. I recognize that. This is bad. This is not allowed. You must go through this process and be more consistent about it. Another thing that's possible is there can be devices that detect at least unshielded circuits, at least the kinds of things that I've been showing, the currently existing camcorder glasses. We can build detection devices. I'm told maybe $100 or so, basically detect a rectifier. You know, there's some possibilities there. Now, this is a cat and mouse game, and we're the mice. So it's still not a very pretty picture. It's easy enough to shield these things, but at least it requires more cost to have shielded camcorder glasses that are difficult to detect. Maybe there's less of a market for them. Maybe they're not as available. So, you know, at least we can do some things there. So I want to look at the trade-offs, because we're talking about the issues. I've tried to say we still have to do these protections someplace. In-person voting, in-person registration, we want to prevent recording, prevent coercion there. So with in-person voting, the coercion has to happen before the voting step. With in-person registration, it has to happen before registration, which might be weeks, months, even years beforehand. So a coercer has to contemplate coercing you well in advance. There are some benefits to forcing that, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes. Here, you have to go through this process and do the checking once per election. In the coercion case for registration, the voters have to appear once. They have to be checked in and carefully checked to see that they're not carrying recording equipment once, ever. Somewhat easier there. In the in-person voting case, for voters, their choices are limited. They can only do this. This process has to take place in a compressed time format during an election period. That's when all this checking goes on. With the in-person registration case, basically, registration could be open 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, whatever. It's fairly available. You can do it at any time. So, you know, it seems easier for a voter this way, and it seems like we have more control. With the voting scenario, these things are being checked by transient staff. Again, permanent, presumably better trained staff is available at the registrar's office. They can do a better job of trying to enforce the rules. In-person voting is very distributed. A lot of places are doing this at the same time on election day, and things are centralized if you do this during registration. Now, centralized doesn't necessarily mean one place. You could imagine the registrar has a van that's sent out a few days a month with all the equipment and permanent personnel to do registration. So it still can be made accessible. Mm-hmm. It changes some of the ways we want to think about this. Certainly, if the registrar is trying to coerce you, then I don't have any good thing to say. I don't have a lot of good things to say even in this case, but at least you know, in that case, I think it's even worse. Okay, so why are we talking about the actual voting being remote in this case? What are the trade-offs here? It seems like if you've done a JCJ-style registration and have legitimate and illegitimate credentials available to you, there's not much more benefit to voting in person. It's certainly easier for a coerced voter to grab 5 minutes on the internet to use real credentials and cast a real vote than to, on election day, find a half hour or more to run down to the poll site to cast a legitimate vote. Potentially, this allows for better voter turnout because voting itself could be easier. Of course, there are trade-offs. Why not vote remotely? First of all, there's this ever-present malware issue, right? If I'm voting on a device that has malware on it, that device could capture my ID potentially, or certainly would see how I'm voting. If this is a reason for using smart cards instead of just simple ID slips of paper, the smart cards could at least protect the credentials, even if the vote itself is being revealed. So a coerced voter really is much better off if the coerced voter can find 5 minutes at some other location rather than home, perhaps. You know, maybe a library is a good place, who knows. The library might not know my vote, but it might not know who I am. So you know, I get some anonymity that way. Another issue is, of course, that some voters are uncomfortable with technology, don't have good access to technology, so it's not a great situation there necessarily. There may be some possibilities. I haven't really explored this very thoroughly, but to use the JCJ-style registration with maybe some sort of a vote by mail or other remote voting scenario, perhaps even in combination with in-person voting in some cases. This is it's not an absolute. This is early. These are preliminary thoughts. So at this point, if you've followed along with me, I'm making a rather surprising and outrageous, perhaps, claim. I'm not entirely comfortable with this claim where I found myself. And I don't expect a lot of people in this room to be at least immediately comfortable with it. But I don't see another conclusion here. Where I find myself is believing that the Australian ballot has had its day. It's had a good century and a half. But it really is no longer the most coercion-resistant voting method, really no longer the best voting method available. And the best thing that I know how to do, if I have carte blanche and I'm designing a new system from scratch, have a lot of flexibility here, is to do something along these lines, something using the JCJ paradigm for getting credentials, and then you can use those credentials from home, from anywhere, whatever. Now, if you accept this claim, then there are some pretty substantial consequences to it. First of all, this whole Uokava story changes dramatically. Think about this in the context where the issue is registration. There is potentially the capability to do good, thorough registration of people before they go overseas or at US consulates or other embassies, other places, get a good set of credentials, and then use them at will. A lot of the Uokava issues that have been a big concern to us may become more feasible. I'm not saying they're easy. I'm not saying this is a complete solution by any means. This is early. But you know, this thing that we have been pushing hard against in many cases might suddenly not be worse than what we're seeing. And to be clear, what's happened now is sort of 5 years ago, here was in-person voting, and here was remote voting in other scenarios. And we've now learned a little bit more about remote voting, and we've gotten better at it. But most of what's happened in recent years is the security and quality of in-person voting has gone down. And we're at a stage where it's crossing over now. We're at this interesting period where in-person voting seems like it may actually be worse than this kind of remote voting. And that's going to change. If you buy into that, that changes a lot in terms of what we can do, at least what's the best thing we can do. Also, this has significant ramifications on protocol design. We have to start rethinking what we've been doing in terms of protocol design. We have, in our protocols, done a lot of work, taken extraordinary efforts in some cases, to mitigate some kinds of coercion when other kinds of coercion are just blatantly simple. Right? This, you print a confirmation behind a screen so that the voter can't see the confirmation at the time the voter is making the selection and whatnot. But the voter might be wearing glasses and recording everything. You know, at this point, it's not worth going to all that trouble. Maybe we ought to rethink some of those protocols, and you know, it may be time to do some redesign of some of those things to see what's best, what's capable, what we can do. So there are some issues here. There are some opportunities here. Let me mention a few of them. One, and this takes me sort of a long time to wrap my mind around and think about the consequences of. If you have credentials that can be used to vote remotely with no monitoring, then maybe you can fake these credentials and avoid being coerced, but you also can voluntarily surrender these credentials to somebody else. You could imagine people collecting large numbers of credentials from people who are voluntarily surrendering them. An individual might be able to collect thousands of credentials. And maybe some of them are fake. So what? Still vote them all. You can imagine a cult environment or just an environment of people who really don't care. In lots of environments, sure, you want to take care of my vote? Cast my vote the way you want. That makes me pretty uncomfortable. But to a large extent, this already exists. Right? People can already say, I'll go to the poll with you. You tell me what to do. Vote by mail, other cases. But even with an in-person scenario, there are already cases where people are, for instance, bussed to the polls in one big group. Let's all go to the poll. Here's what I want you to do. Or I could just tell you, here's what I want you to do. Here's how I want you to vote. Go vote the way I want. It's basically the same thing. It feels a lot more uncomfortable this way. And we may want to spend some time thinking about whether or not we want to develop a system that allows things to be done this way. But it's not out of the question for me to have a system that allows voters to voluntarily nominate proxies, basically. Say, here, you'll be my proxy, you decide how to vote. Now, this does bring up some other situations. Revocation becomes critically important here. And I'm pretty sure this is possible. I really don't know exactly how to do it right now. But you do have to be able to revoke these credentials. When somebody dies, when somebody moves out of a jurisdiction, this is something that has to be researched, has to be thought about. We have to understand better. And I just don't have a thorough understanding. I think it's possible, but I'm just not quite sure yet. We also need to deal with lost credentials. Right? This is going to happen. People will lose their credentials and come back in and say, I need to get new credentials. You have to somehow invalidate the old ones and give them new ones. Well, this has the potential for shifting that time boundary back. Right? I want to coerce you. You've already got your credentials. Well, I tell you, go tell them you've lost your credentials, get new ones while I'm coercing you, while you're wearing the glasses or whatever it is that are now shielded and will get past the current detection. So exactly how we deal with replacement of lost credentials, maybe there's a higher standard of scrutiny. Maybe there's some other methods. I don't know. There's some potential for ideas there. I'm talking about this basically as remote voting, internet-based voting, as the way you vote once you have credentials. But I think there are other ways possible. They certainly warrant some exploration and some new research. And, you know, maybe there are ways of combining this well with in-person voting, vote by mail, other possible scenarios. Okay, so you know, this is not a pretty picture, but it might not be quite as bleak as once thought, and it certainly opens some interesting possibilities. So I think I'm done.
Alan Sherman from UMBC. Very nice talk. An observation, Remotegrity has already proposed these ideas, and they have a variation that works especially well to guard against a corrupt election authority. So for example, in registration, when the authority issues the credential, it could be done in a zero-knowledge way so that the authority does not know which credential was actually issued to the voter.
Yeah, some of these things exist in various forms. Remotegrity has some things. You know, JCJ, of course, I think was the first to introduce this kind of idea. I think this is just a matter of pulling these things together and trying to look at this not so much as, okay, this is a way that we can deal with remote voters, but more that, hey, our standard case is not doing so well. Maybe this needs to be the new standard, you know, the gold standard of the Australian ballot. I think we're in a period where if it's not dead, it's dying. And this is, you know, the kind of thing that I think we can do to try to get past it.
It does seem to be heavily predicated on trusting the poll worker. In particular, I need to know whether I'm being given a legitimate credential or an illegitimate one. If I go in and the basket of legitimate credentials is actually a basket of illegitimate credentials, then I get disenfranchised without ever knowing.
No, that's what the challenge is about. So I grab a basket of legitimate credentials. This is a typical cut and choose type challenge. So all these are claimed to be legitimate. They all get opened except for one that I select at random. And the ones that get opened are proven to be legitimate, which gives me confidence that the one that I selected is also legitimate.
Oh, sorry, I totally missed that.
Okay. Sorry, I guess I wasn't clear.
So my first thought was that you're looking at this problem like a cryptographer.
there might be a reason for that.
I was thinking the same thing. Because there's also a sense in which ubiquitous cameras kill coercion. Because okay. I, as a potential victim, could have a camera pen in my pocket. I hadn't actually seen the camera glasses. I've seen camera pens, which mm-hmm. look like a regular pen, except they happen to be looking forward with a lens. Mm-hmm. And I could have this in my pocket, and it's also recording sound, and you say to me, any employee of mine who votes for that damned man is not going to keep his job. Incidentally, a friend of mine heard exactly that statement from an employer in Indiana a couple years ago. And it is already a felony to coerce. So if I wear my camera pen and sound recorder, and then you face me with this challenge and actually hand me the glasses, I just take this pen to the FBI.
If I'm recording you at the time and you're being explicit about the coercion, yes. You know, yeah. Maybe the coercion is a little bit more subtle. Maybe I'm not fortunate enough to have been recording that moment, even if I'm recording lots of other things. Maybe a spouse has an opportunity when a spouse is not wearing a pen or other things.
There are people who talk about life logging, where you just leave it on all the time.
Yes.
And that strikes me as weird. But on the other hand, I think ultimately this is potentially the death of involuntary coercion. It leaves voluntary vote selling out in the open. But the other thing is that the mechanisms you talked about, a surprising number of them were deployed in Rice in 2006 in Holland. They used both valid and invalid credentials, although they didn't mm-hmm. give you the basket select challenge mechanism. Yeah. They used them only for revocation and reissue mm-hmm. issues. And they got a lot of things right and a lot of things wrong.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I think anyone who moves forward in this direction should look at the lessons that were learned from that experiment.
Very true.
I shouldn't call it an experiment. 20,000
no,
real votes
it was
were
Israel.
Cast.
Yes, thank you. I agree completely.
So again, very nice talk. Enjoyed that a lot. Again, a little plug. I mean, you know about the coercion resistance, caveat coercitor scheme.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah.
That sort of backs off
yeah.
the strict notion of coercion resistance and makes it evidence. And one of the features there which struck me here is that you can actually check that your credential is valid. And that's where you sacrifice the coercion resistance. So it may be worth thinking about. Of course, the big downside is that you can just fake coercion. People can get together and discredit it,
There's a delicate trade-off there. Of course, if you can check, then coercers can be with you checking, and it's a difficult line.
The other quick thought which amused me, and I want to share, maybe it's already occurred to you, but when I was listening to your glasses scheme, I mean, effectively, that's a security protocol for the benefit of the attacker,
yes.
the coercer, and coercion resistance would, in fact, be the existence of an attack against that. So coercion resistance mm-hmm. is sometimes defined as the existence of a strategy.
Yeah,
to
that's a nice
way
to
you
think
want
of
to.
It. Yeah.
And so that's a nice, potentially it's a nice way of inverting our usual way of thinking about things. Which,
indeed.
Actually, I thought that's what you were going to say when you thought about re-evaluating the way we look at security protocols. I thought maybe that's
perhaps
what you
I should
had in
have.
Mind.
If I'd been clever enough to have thought of that, then yes,
and
I think I would have.
I don't know where that goes, but it sounds kind of quite cool. And
I like the idea of
protocol versus protocol.
Being an attacker for the good.
Thanks.
I think I have to agree. There's no doubt that there's voter coercion out there, and we all know that it happens. Although, as Doug pointed out, it is illegal, and there should be some other ways to mitigate it. But I can't kind of make the leap with you that voter coercion has become and will become such a devastating, a destroying factor to voter or election integrity with this new technology yet. Because there's so many other issues, there's the long lines, and we have the Presidential Commission and other things that we have to kind of address with improving our elections in general. So I'm curious as to if there's a basis for the presumption that the voter coercion is really going to be like the death knell of the security of our elections because of the in-place polling.
Well, perhaps I'm being overly dramatic about it. It's a possibility. But I think if we try to look back and trace the whole reason that we build systems around in-person voting, the reason we've developed that, and the long lines that go with that, and the disadvantages as well as the advantages, is around coercion protection. If we're not worried about coercion, if we don't think it's an issue, come to Washington, we vote by mail. There are lots of other things that could be done that might be a lot easier and might be a lot better in other respects. So this is really saying, I'm trying to say that this gold standard of coercion protection has lost its luster.
Are there any studies, though, or even anecdotal collections that to kind of get a sense of
how bad the coercion problem
is?
What's
going on out there?
I haven't found much of anything. I would love to see more. I've begged and pleaded for more. It's very hard to get good evidence of coercion in
some cases. In Washington
State, I know anecdotes. I know of people who have claimed to be coerced. I know of some reports of employers being coercive and employees complaining about it. Of course, I don't know about cases where employees maybe didn't complain, didn't feel justified in doing so, or didn't feel comfortable to do so.
All right. I'd love to let the questioning